Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
The path to reconciliation is one of listening, learning, and growing together. A path that recognises the central place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our past and in our future. It is in that spirit that we acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay tribute to elders past, present and future. Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, which is produced at the Australian National University's Crawford School of Public Policy and co-hosted by me, Sharon Bessel. I'm a Professor of Public Policy here at the Crawford School and Director of the Children's Policy Centre.
And beside you, Sharon, Anna-Greta Hunter, cardiologist, physician and the Human Futures Fellow with the ANU College of Health and Medicine.
Hello and welcome to Policy Forum Pod. This week, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, handed down Australia's budget, and today we're going to be discussing the values and the leadership style behind that budget. Anna-Greta, this is a conversation that I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, Sharon, we've been talking about this federal budget now since the election last year, and I think with some great hopes as to the future. And so today's conversation is one that I'm certainly looking forward to immensely. The federal budget is, of course, a reflection of the values of a nation. It creates a narrative about its leadership and about its future goals. This week, Jim Chalmers has handed down his second budget, a budget that aims to balance the needs of the people and the challenges of the current economic environment. And it appears to create that balance well, lifting the level of support for low-income Australians and those on social security payments, as well as offering Australia its first budget surplus in 15 years. Last year, we'd seen some signs of more significant structural change, talk of wellbeing, a wellbeing budget, an approach that integrates economics, society and environment as goals for fiscal policy. But in a year in which economic policy has been dominated by talk of inflation, the structural shifts that perhaps could have happened have been maybe more muted. Despite this, it is a remarkable budget created by a new Treasurer and his team who are committed to using economics to achieve social change in Australia, and who've created a budget that some are describing as the best in quite some time. So to discuss the tone, the tenor, the spending decisions made in this federal budget, we are joined by Frank Bongiorno.
Frank Bongiorno is Professor of History here at the Australian National University with a particular interest in the history of the Australian Labor Party. His most recent book, which is a fabulous read, is Dreamers and Schemers, A Political History of Australia, and that was published last year. Frank, welcome to you.
Delighted to be here.
It's great to have you back on the pod. I wanted to begin by asking what your reflections are, what you think of this budget, and what you think are the values and ideas that have informed it. There will be, I think, a lot of commentary about this over the weeks to come. Are we seeing significant change? Frank, would you like to start us off with your broad reflections?
Yeah, thanks, Sharon. Yeah, I think it's probably about as good a budget as we could expect in the circumstances. And what I have in mind in terms of those circumstances is the anticipation of worse economic times. So even though this budget delivers a surplus in the first for many years, I think it projects future deficits and also just an expectation of a slower growth, including pressure on employment, as you'd expect. But the other setting that's really problematic for this government is that there are big tax cuts ahead, including for very well-off Australians. And that has provided, I think, a key part of the context in which this budget is being delivered, what it can afford to give in terms of relief for those who are less well off is basically being conditioned by the fact that you've got, I think, about $69 billion essentially in tax cuts for the wealthy over the forward estimates period, over the 4 years. So I think in those circumstances, the budget is probably as good as it could be in terms of its sort of social justice and redistributive aspects.
Yeah, the nuance of the economics here is really quite remarkable, to come up with a surplus in this particular environment and after a decade of very interesting politics in Australia. I'm interested in the political strategy that's gone into this budget as well. It's been particularly interesting to watch the debate that's been fostered in the weeks beforehand, the usual leaks, but leaks that I thought were really starting us around discussion of some of the serious issues of our time, things like whether to raise the rate of job seeker, the sort of support that we give to people who are living in precarity, the single parent supports, and the debate, as Frank's already mentioned, about the Stage 3 tax cuts. It really did strike me that this government is interested in fostering robust discussion about issues such as poverty and around economic responsibility. What did you make of their political strategy around the budget, Frank? I'd be really interested in your thoughts.
Well, I think this is a government that deserves some credit for allowing debates to run around a whole range of issues. I mean, I'm aware of it in one particular area of great interest to me, and that's arts and cultural policy, where, you know, it has appointed advisory committees and basically allowed a debate to run. And when it's delivered its budget measures, they don't entirely reflect the advice that it's is out there, in which it's pretty open about getting. And I think that there's an element of that with the budget more generally. It's obviously allowed a debate to run over social security issues. It appointed an economic inclusion committee. That committee made a recommendation around increasing the job seeker payment. For a while there, it looked like the government would confine any increase to the over 55s. In the budget, it has delivered a pretty modest increase of $40 a fortnight more generally, which sort of moves in the right direction, but geez, very slowly. It basically also says that anyone on a job seeker payment will remain well and truly below the poverty line. And of course, people's sense of the possibilities here and their expectations were rightly raised by the COVID period, where there were very significant increases that basically dragged a lot of people temporarily out of poverty. This will be a problem for the government going forward. There will be continuing pressure, and again, quite rightly, I think, on a government that says it's driven by values such as economic and social inclusion, to ensure that it doesn't confine one particular category of welfare recipients, those looking for a job, to a kind of more or less permanent poverty. And it's a real problem given the current cost of living issues, and in particular the cost of housing, which is inaccessible really to people on those sorts of payments. So full marks to the government for some movement here, but it's nowhere near enough, and it's certainly not enough in the context of the big $25 a day tax cuts that it's going to deliver to the wealthy in the very near future, because it basically went to the last election supporting an initiative of the Morrison government.
Frank, you started to talk about, you know, some of the things that I want to pick up on and delve into a little more deeply here. You know, in my view, the budget doesn't go far enough to seriously dent poverty in Australia, but it does make a start, as you say. And I think that increase in JobKeeper is remarkable, and it's a remarkable shift, even though people who are relying on working age benefits in Australia will still be living in poverty. And I think our listeners are not going to be surprised by me making those comments that I don't think it went anywhere near far enough around poverty. But I do think one of the most important shifts was that change in the eligibility for single parent payment. So the parents are now moved to JobSeeker when their youngest child is 14 rather than 8. And this reverses a terrible example of the absence of care in government policy. One of the things that I hear repeatedly in my research is parents talking about their dread of their child's 8th birthday. You know, single parents talking about that dread. And often children being very aware that when they turn 8, the circumstances of their family is going to change And that's horrendous to hear children and their parents talking about. Frank, I'd really love to hear you talk a little bit more about how you think this budget compares with the efforts of previous governments to foster justice and equity. How important is the shift that we're starting to see in resetting the way we think about inequality and fairness in Australia?
Well, look, Sharon, I think if we think of a budget, as I think Anna Greta said at the beginning, as a statement of values, as what a government stands for, I mean, clearly there are a lot of very positive signs in this particular budget. And the one you mention is certainly emblematic. The Gillard government received a lot of blame for effectively acquiescing in that policy or continuing that policy, which I think went back even further to coalition governments. And as you point out, I mean, it is punishes parents as well as children, and it lacked fairness. Politicians often talk about the pub test, and it clearly doesn't pass that. In the same way as the job seeker rate doesn't pass any pub test. I mean, if you basically have a rate set at a level that guarantees poverty, you don't have a functioning welfare state. And we know at the moment that there are particular problems in Australia, and especially metropolitan Australia, with housing, which means that you're effectively consigning such people to incredible distress, I think, in terms of their ability to gain access to shelter, which most of us would regard as a right, not a privilege. Look, it does head in the right direction. I mean, the government will point to the fact that we can't see any particular measure in isolation. It's also increased its support for bulk billing. And I know just from speaking to my own students how important something like bulk billing is and the accessibility of Medicare bulk billing if you don't have much money, because your medical expenses can mount very quickly. They'll also point to the downward pressure that they're placing on household energy bills, you know, another major area of you know, the household budget for most people. So, and you know, I think that's a reasonable claim too, that we shouldn't just see, you know, any of these measures in isolation. They need to be seen as part of a broader budget package. But there is still a long way to go, and in a really difficult fiscal environment and potentially a very difficult macroeconomic environment going forward. So, you know, this is a government that I think is going to have to really turn its attention to the issue of welfare payments more generally. When I look back to the Rudd era, I see, you know, many failures, but one thing that it did and deserves full commendation for was its really serious increase in the level of the pension, the age pension. And you know, I think this is a government that needs to turn to, especially to the unemployment benefits, to JobSeeker. And again, in a context where we may well see rising unemployment in the not very distant future. I mean, if the projections that we're getting from Treasury about growth turn out to be accurate, we could find ourselves not just in an inflationary environment for a while, but also in one that sees a rise in unemployment. And that will mean that a lot more people are going to be seeking access to JobSeeker.
It is a complex economic environment, and certainly I'm sure that for many listeners, the change in the healthcare environment has been a significant one, as you mentioned, improving rates of bulk billing, and it does address some of the economic challenges for people who are working in primary care as well. So they are significant changes. When we spoke about childhood maltreatment on a recent episode, that this is part of the argument for a wellbeing framework shift, is if we do address poverty in a deep way, that we can decrease the need for healthcare intervention. And so that might be part of what we can see, a conversation that we see fostered over the years ahead. But we're going to bring this part of the conversation to a close just shortly, and I'd like to finish by talking about the overall impact of this budget. It appears to be informed by intelligent and nuanced political, social, and economic strategy. And I'm wondering, is this a transformative government? Are we seeing echoes of a Whitlam-esque type government change? Are we looking at parts of the Hawke-Keating government? Are we looking at the sorts of changes and the transformation that took place when John Howard was elected? Or is the velocity of change different in our era of a time of multiple crises and more polarised politics? I'm wondering very much on to hear both of your thoughts on the contemporary Australian politics and the way in which we can offer hope in these complex times. Frank, do you think this is a transformative government? Are we seeing a seismic shift in politics, or is this the same as what we've seen in the last decade?
I think it's very hard to say whether it's going to be a transformative government. You know, if we look at it in, you know, the kind of very wide context or long context of Australian political history since Federation, you know, 120 odd years, it's probably too early to say. I mean, it has set out its identity and approach in quite obvious contrast with some of the governments we've had in the more recent past, the emphasis on orderly process, on fostering trust, on, you know, being an adult government. All of that is an implied critique of some of the wilder aspects, I think, particularly of the Morrison period, but also, you know, I think, you know, looking back to some of the chaos that we saw under both Abbott and Turnbull, I think there's also a quiet critique going on there of the Rudd government, frankly, of a government that set too many hares running at once, in which there was a lack of follow through, in which debates were certainly allowed to run, but they were allowed to run in a way that saw them lurch entirely out of the control of that government. One thinks of the, you know, climate change debate and debates over the mining tax and all the rest of it. So I think this is a government that looks like it's learnt from some of those failures. That's not frightened, I think, of letting a debate run. That's not utterly obsessed with winning every day in the media, and which wants to, you know, to turn itself into a long-term or at least medium-term government. I mean, the phrase that was often used during the 1980s in relation to the Hawke government was the idea of turning Labor into the natural party of government. And again, the context for that is that Labor's almost never been the natural party of government. I mean, for the Commonwealth, for the history of you know, since Federation, the non-Labor parties have governed for about two-thirds of the time. Labor has governed for about a third of the time. Labor governments tend to be almost aberrant in many respects. And I think this is a government that's determined that when it introduces a change, when it introduces good policy, evidence-based policy, that it's going to stick. And the only way it can make it stick is by achieving some sort of longevity. So, you know, if one is inclined to a more generous reading of this budget, you'd basically do it in those terms, that this is a government that understands that you're not going to solve every problem that's accumulated over a long period in one or two budgets, that at a minimum you're going to need a couple of terms to really have a big impact on a lot of these key social and economic indicators, and that the only way you're going to be able to do that is through a fairly cautious and orderly approach. I mean, I can kind of see why this government is so reluctant to do anything in relation to those stage three tax cuts, because it doesn't want to end up being accused of a government that breaches faith. It doesn't want to raise the spectre of, you know, the Abbott and Hockey 2014 budget, which broke a whole bunch of core promises. So I can kind of see what they're doing, but the pressure will remain, I think, for a government that calls itself values-based and values-driven to look at some of these really key areas of policy for those who are marginalised, those who are excluded.
So potentially really quite a transformative approach, I think, but time will tell. And perhaps it is a budget that sets up a multi-term government. Listeners, we will take a short break here and return to continue unpacking the most recent federal budget.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Listeners, welcome back. We're here with Frank Bongiorno talking about the most recent Australian federal budget. Frank, I just wanted to shift pace a little bit in this second half of our conversation and think a bit more broadly about changing attitudes in Australia. Last October's budget was framed as the beginning of a wellbeing budget, and the Treasurer then wrote the essay in the Monthly, which was criticised more than embraced by the progressive side of politics and was pretty much roundly condemned by the conservative side. This budget didn't continue so strongly with that narrative of wellbeing, although we see elements that may underpin a future wellbeing approach. Anna-Greta and I have been reflecting on what's happening here, and we'd love your thoughts. Why didn't that monthly essay, regardless of the style or the quotes that were used from ancient Greek philosophers, trigger the serious debate that it really deserved? Have we become cautious as a nation in engaging with new and radical ideas?
Yeah, I mean, the essay that Jim Chalmers produced for the monthly projected, a kind of a values-based capitalism, didn't it? But it seemed to me really to lack a kind of core set of ideas, in contrast, for instance, with similar kinds of essays produced by Kevin Rudd, 15 or so years ago, where he kind of proclaimed the end of neoliberalism, and there did seem to be a much stronger sense of where he wanted to take the country economically. I didn't gain that from the Chalmers essay, I have to say, and it gained quite a bit of media attention, some reasonably friendly, some hostile, and some kind of, shrugging of the shoulders. And I probably was somewhat in the third of those categories. He has spoken about the idea of wellbeing budgets from, well before Labor won office. I mean, you remember he was ridiculed for it by the previous Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg. I think it reflects to some extent, obviously, much broader changes in thinking about, an old concept in a way, quality of life, and the importance of thinking about economic indicators in a much broader context. The term work-life balance has now been around for a very long time, for instance, and I suspect that the pandemic in particular has shifted a lot of these sorts of debates. I mean, some of the key debates in Australia today are not about, narrow economic indicators. They're about, what should be the appropriate balance between working from home and working in an office or some other workplace. And how do you manage that? How do you manage that in terms of people's home lives as well as their working lives? How do we deal with the gender implications of that sort of approach? We know from studies done by the Grattan Institute, for instance, quite early in the pandemic, I guess in 2021, that women often bore the burden of this move, this shift towards the home becoming, more of a site of production of work, that it was often women who bore, who had to carry the burden of that sort of transformation. So, it's promising, I think, that we're talking in these sorts of terms again. You'll remember that I think it was the Abbott government abolished the women's statement that went with budgets, going all the way back to 1984, that basically set out the implications of particular budget measures for women. I think we've returned to that sort of statement. That's an important thing to do because it matters a lot. These issues are very much on the agenda. If there was one cohort that was absolutely critical, I think, to the result of the last election, it was women. And so it's entirely both sensible and just that this government should be looking at its budgets, or its budget in these sorts of contexts, I think.
Frank, you've touched on the issues that really have increasingly taken central stage in Australian politics, and it strikes me that this is a shift from some of the more toxic politics that dominated debate over the last decade. Do you think we are seeing, as a nation, that we are beginning to appreciate the benefits of good quality political debate in contrast to the toxic polarising politics that we've experienced over the last decade? Do you think the Australian population is on board for this, perhaps reflected through the election of a larger than usual crossbench?
Well, I think the signs are very good at the moment. The last election was a very ambiguous result, wasn't it? We saw certainly a great surge of support for minor parties and independents, and a very poor primary vote even for the winning party, the Labor Party, in the low 30s, not much better for the coalition. It was a real shake-up in all sorts of respects that was widely interpreted as a statement on those toxic politics of you know, the last decade, if not longer. So in that sense, the signs are good. Since the election, the government has travelled pretty well in the polls, I think, and of course won a surprise by-election really in Aston, a seat on the sort of, you know, in outer Melbourne that has generally leaned towards the Liberal Party. And so, you know, as far as we can tell, people are responding positively to what does seem to be a new approach to government. It's one where I think it is more consultative, where there is much more of an emphasis, I think, on letting debates run in the community. This government has unleashed an enormous number of commissions and inquiries, you know, which does recall the Whitlam government in many respects. And that's a good thing. I mean, it's likely to lead to better evidence-based policy if you do, you know, some decent sort of inquiries into things like the Reserve Bank or immigration or whatever it happens to be. I guess the Robo-Debt Royal Commission also comes into this in terms of hopefully improving the quality of government. But, of course, it also raises expectations. Albanese has from time to time, particularly I think at the last election, deployed a language of universalism. The most obvious place he did that was in relation to childcare. The first of the budgets back in October last year was very much about election promises, and childcare was one of those. Inevitably, in this sort of situation, people's expectations of what government can deliver will be raised. We're already seeing something that was utterly predictable, because it happens with every Labor government, that, you know, very quickly there are criticisms from further to the left that they're not doing things fast enough, they're not doing enough, they've become beholden to the bureaucracy, they're too close to business. Those criticisms often carry weight. We shouldn't dismiss them. But that said, they're also the kinds of criticisms that have attached to every Labor government I can think of, basically going all the way back to at least 1910 and Andrew Fisher. They certainly attached to the Hawke government, for instance, coming out of the 1983 election. Similar things were said about Rudd before terribly far into that government. So, you know, I'm not suggesting for a moment they should be treated as a grain of salt, but they do reprise, I think, common criticisms of Labor governments that you know, for very good reasons, can't do everything at once.
Frank, that's such an extraordinary mapping of how we can think about, you know, current politics and current policy decisions in historical context, and also of the challenging context that the current government finds itself in. This is a conversation that I would like to keep going for much, much longer, but we are going to need to begin to draw to a close. And as we do close, I'd like to ask you about your thoughts on Australia's relationship with the United Kingdom. We can't ignore the fact that in the same week as the 2023 budget was brought down, we also had the coronation of a new king in the United Kingdom. And it's striking when we look at the UK at present, how different the political narrative is from that we've seen around Australia's budget. Principles of well-being and caring do appear to be reshaping the political discourse in Australia. And we've seen some genuine concern for those who are doing it tough through the budget measures. And we're also trying to come to terms with the violence and colonisation of our past, particularly through the referendum on The Voice. And it seems that all of this takes us a very long way from that colonial past, and also a long way from the current values that appear to be underpinning the British government, despite some really progressive things happening in Scotland and Wales. You know, in England, we see a real kind of winding back of a concern for those who are the most vulnerable. So in closing, Frank, I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you see the future of Australia's relationship with the UK and how you see Australia's relationship with its new king.
Well, I mean, one of the contexts, I guess, for Australia's relationship with Britain at the moment is AUKUS, which involves Australia, the United States and Britain, the United Kingdom, and envisages, an increasingly close security relationship. And that is one of the areas where the Albanese government has been criticised. I mean, the US aspects of it have raised the spectre of, you know, can our sovereignty be preserved in this sort of environment? And the UK aspects of it look somewhat nostalgic. This all, I guess, is happening side by side with those developments in Britain, the death of Queen Elizabeth, the coronation of Charles III, and a government that remains formally committed to a republic, although has basically said that it won't be taking up the issue in this term, that its priority in this term is the First Nations voice to Parliament. The government cleared the decks last year with a lot of legislation it clearly wanted to get out of the way by Christmas because of the amount of energy that it realised would be going into the debate over the voice to Parliament this year. And that issue in a whole range of complex ways is entangled with our relationship with Britain and with the British heritage in Australia. It's also very much about the place of Indigenous people, of First Nations people, within the policy order that we've been talking about. In future budgets, the voice to Parliament will have a role to play. And some people are very frightened about this, as if there's something fundamentally troubling or undemocratic about allowing people to actually have a say in the policy issues that directly affect their lives. Going forward, we may well be dealing here with the last budget or perhaps the penultimate budget is delivered within an environment where the voice doesn't exist. I mean, the signs at the moment, I think, are somewhat promising. I mean, it's still a long way to go, but it may well be that when we sit here in a couple of years' time and we're talking about budgets, one of the things we'll also be talking about is the role that the voice to Parliament played in articulating the interests of Indigenous people in the context of government spending priorities.
Frank, what an extraordinary place to leave what has been a very informative and wonderful discussion. It's been so great having you with us to discuss the most recent federal budget. And I think if you listeners like me, you might find your imagination sparked thinking about Australia's future through the prism of the political change we've seen over the last year or so. There is great hope. So thank you so much for your time today, Frank Bongiorno. It's been wonderful having you with us.
Absolute pleasure, Anna-Greta and Sharon. Thanks so much for inviting me on.
Listeners, thank you for joining us for what was a remarkable conversation. It is always such a pleasure to listen to Frank Bongiorno. And that conversation gave us insights not only into the nature of the budget and the values that are underpinning it, but also put that budget into a wider context of Australia's political history. And I think that's such an important thing for us to hear. The budget, as we've heard, was certainly not perfect, but it certainly does signal a very new direction in Australia, where we are paying close attention to how those who are most vulnerable can be better supported. And that's an exciting trajectory for us to be moving towards. On our next episode, we'll be continuing the conversation around the 2023 federal budget, and we'll be talking with Paul Burke and Elise Klein to get a deeper insight into what the budget means for some significant policy issues in Australia. This podcast is produced by policyforum.net, and we'll leave a link to the publications and the sources that we've talked about in the show notes. If you like this episode, and we really hope you liked it as much as we did, don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're feeling generous, you can leave us a review. It's the best way for other people to be able to find out about Policy Forum Pod. We love hearing from you, so please do reach out to us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, that's at APPS Policy Forum, or drop us an email at podcast@policyforum.net. And that's all we have time for until next week. So from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
And from me, Anna-Greta Hunter, see you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.